This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Thad McElroy from The Future of Publishing in San Francisco. Well, it's really good to have you here, Thad.
Thanks, David. Thanks for inviting me. When we had our first conversation, I realized that we could have fun with it. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's interesting to note that we've never crossed paths despite working in the publishing business in similar areas of interest for a really long time, which shows you that even though it is a fairly small business, there are many, many entry points and threads in the publishing business. So it's possible to work in similar interest areas and never cross paths.
Yeah, but it's always great to finally connect. So I'm glad we did.
I've been interested in your work for a while. So maybe you should talk a little bit, you don't have to tell the whole story, but maybe a little bit of background about your connection to publishing and how you got started.
Sure. I think that, because I focus on technology, a lot of people assume that I came out of a technology background or, had this kind of superficial relationship with publishing. But in fact, I started as a bookseller in Toronto in the 1970s and then started my own publishing company also in the 1970s in Toronto, was a small trade publisher there, ran that for 5 years until I ran it into the ground and moved on from there.
Easily done in publishing.
It really is. Yep. I learned that. And then, I became an author, and then I went to book packaging for a while. But then technology, the turning point for me was desktop publishing, 1988, actually before 88, 85, 86, when the first PageMaker, Macintosh, laser printers, it was just like a light went on, and I could see that this was going to be an important part of the future of publishing.
Well, I started working with computers. In my experience, I started in printing in the early 70s with metal, but by the 80s, like you, I still was using more of the older technology, but I was thrilled with the advent of personal computers. I don't know whether you had this experience, but the only time I had ever really touched a computer was in high school when we had access to a mainframe computer that was run, in our case, at Dartmouth University, and we had a telephone link to there, and would type in, and they taught us BASIC, when I was a senior in high school, and that was just not interesting.
You didn't find it interesting?
No, I thought it was interesting, but not captivating, let's put it that way. And I'm a bad typist. I learned touch typing at an early age, but I'm really not a good typist. And so typing on an unforgiving node, as those were, if you made one, any typo, garbage in, garbage out, you would get no response. So
unforgiving.
But desktop publishing in the whole, the Apple computer was just thrilling. In terms of what it opened up. Now, I also, there was that whole period where there was a lot of resistance to desktop publishing in the publishing business, not only from the big guys, but from anyone who was involved in typesetting, who doubted the quality of the output that you would get from desktop publishing. But as it is true with almost any technology, at the beginning, it's kind of messy.
I think there's a real comparison with what's going on with AI. But I think part of the resistance is that same kind of, the quality's not very good. ChatGPT, I asked it a few questions and the answer was really stupid. And it feels to me very much like, I tried running a page through PageMaker and the output was really crummy and the resolution was not high enough. And the AI, it mirrors to me in many ways that same kind of rhetoric.
Well, I think that's true. But you can see why that is the case for so many people who have, the longer you've done something a certain way, the harder it is to accept a change in your methodology. And
sure.
there's a real, I think that's a legitimate resistance. Sometimes it gets written off as, you know, people are just in the publishing business, very conservative, and they don't want to change. But part of it is there's a learning curve to new technology. Yeah. And just, that's really what you're talking about, that you have to make a commitment to it. And for some people, you know, who are really busy, very difficult to carve out the time to learn a new technology that you will only, you have to use simultaneously with your existing technology.
And I think the other thing was that, you know, typesetting, the whole print process was a craft industry, a deeply craft, you know, based industry with a very rich tradition and a rich set of practice that desktop publishing undermined that. It didn't remove all sense of craft, but it became very different than, you know, if you compare conversations with typographers 100 years ago to ones today, it's not the same.
No, but I think at the early stage, it was that way. But then as time went on, the desktop publishing software improved, and it isn't really desktop publishing anymore because it's, you know, more like, people don't really use Microsoft Word to print very often.
Oh, I mean, you'd be surprised.
People do but not as many books are produced with that software. You know, people use it in business all the time. And I think Microsoft Publisher, which is another, you know, kind of now dead end technology, is still in use, I think, by people. Although I did get a message from Microsoft yesterday saying that they are no longer supporting Microsoft Publisher as part of Office 365.
Oh, I didn't see that. That's interesting. That's a little end of an era.
But what I was going to ask you really is, do you feel like in the, you know, since you started with desktop publishing really early and you've been able to see how technology has changed over the last now almost 40 years, my supposition is that the technology has become adopted into regular practice. You know, what is now, you know, whether it's Adobe or, Quark to some extent.
No, it's gone.
You're right. Just about but gone. InDesign really now is kind of the main technology, but that has its roots in essentially the development of what was then called desktop publishing.
Absolutely. I worked with Adobe at that time. I was working at Siebold, and we were very intimate with Adobe through the whole creation of that product of Adobe InDesign. And, you know, the two men who founded Adobe were craftspeople. They were computer scientists, but they deeply appreciated, you know, the craft of publishing, particularly of typography. And they added the PostScript fonts, and it was important to them spiritually as well as a business. And so that made them your wonderful progenitors of the business. Likewise, your PageMaker came out from a guy named Paul Brainard, who had worked in the newspaper industry for a long time and worked in composition in the newspaper industry. So they weren't carpetbaggers. These were the real McCoy.
Right. And they were... They brought us into a kind of amazing world. If you think about what's now possible in terms of workflow, when I think about the improvement in how we can work in terms of making books compared to what it was even 10 years ago, it's really remarkable.
And the whole it's so interesting to think about self-publishing in that context. And clearly, there was a self-publishing business before all of this technology, but it is a very small business. There are very few people who had the resources to be able to pull their own publishing project together, and it was impossible to distribute and all that sort of thing. And this technology enablement is really intriguing because we've gone from no self-publishing essentially to an enormous part of the publishing ecosystem. And, you know, I don't know what numbers you believe, because the numbers are all a little bit, you know, a matter of faith, but I think the self-publishing industry is probably 20% or so of all books sold, and that's a technology enablement.
Oh, I think it's actually higher if you include, and of course, yeah, you're right. There is no real evidentiary proof of this, but no. There are ways we can infer.
Yes.
I think the number of books that are published on Amazon, whether it's in many cases digitally, not necessarily print, is really large. And I think there's a dollar amount there that we just don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly by number of titles, we know that's for sure. You know, because there's about 2.5 million books published every year, of which well under 300,000 are coming out of the commercial publishers. The rest are coming from self-published authors. So by title count, the self-publishers have, you know, walked away with business. By total dollar sales volume, I think we're on more or less the same page. There's a lot going on there that doesn't get reported. We get enough anecdotal evidence from smart people that you think, okay, yeah, this is at least, you know, 2.5-3 million just going through Amazon.
Yeah, and I think it is powerful in the, I mean, there are, it's it, like everything else, it is, you know, as we know, a double-edged sword, or more complex than simple, because for most people in publishing, what we feel is the abundance of product, which is very similar to what's happened in the music business, and maybe less so in film, but still possible there, where you can make a movie on an iPhone. You can make music with very simple tools now. Recorded music is really easy to do. And
really,
in the same way that it's pretty easy to make a book. And some of it is rough. I mean, and there's a lot of, you know, there are people who will complain that the editing quality isn't there, and et cetera, which is all true. And the problem with all the output is that it makes the signal to noise ratio smaller. But there is also another side to that, and that is that it means that people have more choice. And so that's, for a lot of people, that's really good. Like if you like a certain kind of writing and it wasn't going to be widely available to you in the commercial world and now is widely available to you in the, whether it's self-publishing or assisted publishing or hybrid publishing or even independent publishing, there's more opportunity for readers. The challenge for the creators and for the publishers is figuring out how to navigate that.
Which brings us to metadata.
Yes. And that's another piece of your work that I think is really interesting. And for people who are listening, and if you're in the publishing business, you know what metadata is. When we say metadata, we refer to what used to be called the bibliographical data about a book. But now, of course, it's more complex when you take into account digital publishing or the exigencies of e-commerce and digital transmission of information. We send out a lot of information about books, and that's metadata. But I think it's,
I think for people, you know, when you talk about people outside the industry not appreciating what metadata is, it's so appropriate to start by saying it's the title, it's the name of the author, it's the price, is it paperback or digital? That's metadata. But the fundamental of metadata, it's a fancy term that's makes it sound far more complicated than it is, but also, as you're saying, there's a depth to it that does take a lot of skill. But you know, we've learned that as long as you make sure you get all of those basics right, the book is now on sale, available, findable. So you've done the basic metadata work.
Right. Although there are issues still. You know, we always wanted to have a kind of industry-wide standard for doing business. You know, the underlying tools of business are best if they are standards. So we have the ISBN, the International Standard Book Number. That is a common number, except that our friends at Amazon dispense with.
They really undermine that system.
Exactly. And then we have differentiations in subject categorization, you know, that creates also difficulties for readers and creators. Because if books are not, if the categories are not either correct in their making or broad enough or specific enough, both, then it's harder to categorize books. And it's also harder to find books when you are interested in a particular category. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, what people have learned through search on Google in particular, but any search engine, is a kind of, that's a use of metadata that they feel is more flexible than searching for books. Do you agree with that?
Well, I guess there's two sides of it that I'm thinking about as we're talking about it. There's, you know, on the one hand, you know, Google does an amazing job with natural language search. And, you know, if there was no formal metadata about a book, Google could still find it. But on the other hand, you know, when you go deep into the weeds on this stuff, it will be found more readily and more accurately if you also get that data right. And so Google looks for multiple signals when a query comes in, and it does look for metadata, but if it doesn't find that, and can find a description of the book, that book still might surface. So metadata becomes a fine-tuning tool that, you know, in some ways you would say to an author, well, if I get my metadata right, how many more books am I going to sell? And it might be, you know, maybe it's only going to be 10% more. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily sound like a lot. But for a self-published author, that can be a whole bunch of books. And every author wants to optimize the process and reach as many readers as possible. And every publisher wants their books to reach as many readers as possible. And so I get upset when publishers in particular don't pay enough attention to metadata. Authors, I understand, it's complicated. You know, I let you off the hook, though I remind you, you would sell more books if you would pay attention. Publishers, that's part of your job. Part of your job is getting the metadata right for the authors that you publish. So please pay attention.
Right. But it's also, I think it's hard for publishers and authors alike when they're thinking about metadata, because you're also then thinking about the reader and their, what they want, what they're looking for. Whereas you know your product really well. So you're thinking of it from the product side, what we used to call product-centric. Yes. And it's hard to interpolate what a searcher, a reader, would be interested in finding about your book, because you have to take yourself out of the product and put yourself in the mind of a reader. And I think
that's
that
a good point.
Sometimes hard. It's metadata kind of falls into marketing. Not editorial. And it's sort of, it's a place where the two cross.
But, you know, I bet and you know, Pete McCarthy, you must have run into him, right? You know, he's the smartest guy in the metadata room always. And he makes the argument you're making, you know, that you've got to be thinking sort of reader on in rather than product on out. And I see that argument, and I see the validity of the argument. But I also think, you know, that if your book is the right product, in quotation marks, that a reader is looking for at that moment, then surely the best metadata is the most accurate, the most verbose, you know, because if indeed it correctly describes your book and what the contents are and, you know, who the intended audience is, that should be enough. You shouldn't have to go, well, the book's actually not, doesn't really tell the reader what it needs to know. We say, well, that's a mistake, surely, too.
This sort of leads us in naturally, I think, into talking about AI, because I know you've really spent a lot of time thinking about AI, working with AI, unlike many of our colleagues who either don't have time or don't have the desire to do it or don't feel comfortable with it. and I'm probably somewhere in there. I'm really interested in AI, but I just have more trouble finding time to understand it and to navigate it.
It's a real time suck.
And it's changing rapidly. So if I learn something today, it probably is helpful for what happens tomorrow, but it still takes a lot of time. But I was thinking as we were talking that, you know, will AI, because it will find people will find applications for AI in all kinds of levels of business, and publishing is included in that, where I wonder if AI will change the way metadata works also. Mm-hmm. Not saying that you would use AI to write it, although in theory, you could take an entire book, run it through an AI trained in metadata, and have the metadata make suggestions for a better, you know, a really good description of the book. Here are the keywords.
That's happening now, David. There are products that do that. I was meeting yesterday with the folks at Verastage, who have a product called Insight, and it's a kind of dashboard for book publishers that's completely AI powered, let's say. And the first thing you do with that product, you get a new manuscript in, you upload it to the Insight dashboard, and immediately it gives you recommendations on subject categories. It gives you a draft press release to send out with the book. It gives you comps. It does a really sophisticated job of giving comparative titles that you could be marketing against. It gives you the buy sacks and so on and so on. So it's doing that. There are very practical tools that are starting to be developed.
Well, is this going to be a situation where you have to be a large publisher to, to do this?
No, one of the great things that I think great things about the AI technology is cheap. It's not expensive. You know, the premium version of ChatGPT is $20 a month. You know, that's less than you're paying. Well, probably about what you're paying for Microsoft 365. It's less than you're paying for the Adobe Creative Suite, but it's in keeping with, you know, those kind of software subscriptions. So even though it's, you know, it's fancy, complex stuff in many ways, it's not expensive stuff.
So the thing that you were just talking about, you said it was Verastage. Do you think, is that a commercial product now, or is it in a kind of beta?
No, it's commercial. When I spoke to them yesterday, they've got publishers all over the world, in particular France, Italy, Spain, America, Europe, UK. So they've got, I don't know how many, you know, probably, I don't know how many customers, but it is out there. It is being used every day.
Well, to me, that is a practical value for any publisher, because it is time consuming to do metadata well. I think even if the software got you 85% of the way there, that would be a big savings for a lot of people.
Indeed.
And it would, if it's improving your output, and, you know, I mean, the idea of writing a press release is really painful for a lot of publishers. It's just not fun.
Yeah. And it does an amazingly good job. Again, you're going to tweak it. You're not just going to send out its first draft, but the first drafts are getting good. And the same point you're making in terms of the transition of the software, you know, it's now been, when we're at 2.5 years, I guess, since ChatGPT was released. And the change that I've seen in that time is breathtaking. Even the changes I've seen in the last 3 weeks are breathtaking. The products that are coming out now from those same companies, it's astounding how good they are and how powerful they are. I won't go down the road on all of them, but, you know, I spoke to a publisher the other day who's very deeply into AI, and he said he's already visualizing a time not so long from now where you could instruct an AI agent, I want to get a best-selling book. I want you to write that. I want you to research it. I want you to write it. And I want you to do all of the stages. I want you then to edit it. I want you to market it. I want you to, you know, set the specifications for the print version, every single step. And it's one of the things that I've always, you know, had as kind of little fantasy, the one button publishing company you push publish, and that's it.
I mean, this sort of goes to my earlier allusion, I think, to the flattening of information and ideas, because if the, you know, we imagine that the software is trained on a certain data set. It could be a large data set, but it's still going to be repetitive, at a certain point. It is only capable of bringing you back what it knows. And the data set is its limitation.
That's a misconception, because it's not a database per se. You know, I think people use the kind of search paradigm and the database paradigm and think it through a little bit as if, you know, they're going into Google and Google only knows what it knows, only what it can find. This is a language model, and it models language. It's not modeling information. And so, you know, having been fed literally billions of instances of language and the construction of language, it has a profoundly intimate understanding of how language is expressed, and it can create novel instances. It's not, you know, parroting what's already been written. It's understanding the patterns of what's already been written and published, and then extrapolating from that. It's extraordinary. The worst of it's terrible. The best of it's extraordinary. And I think one of the things you're making me think about there, if we take sort of the history of self-publishing, you take it back from the days before self-publishing was accessible or possible, and then, you know, the purists just decry the 2 million crappy books, they would say, that get published by self-published authors every year. And, you know, this democratization that the technology affords has led to this lessening of quality, they would argue. And now we have AI, which theoretically can generate all of those books, can write them at that level of crappy quality. And so now there's, you know, one of the fears is, you know, now there's going to be 5 million a year, 10 million a year. But what that ultimately does is brings us back to quality. Because when, you know, the world is covered with crap, then you're looking for the diamonds, you know, in that. And I don't feel, you know, I'm not worried about the world getting dumbed down any dumber than it is already. I think it really creates a scenario where people start to really look for what's the finest.
Well, of course, then you could use an AI agent to find you the best books. And no. It could, in theory, since AI can read a lot faster than we can, could read a lot of books and say, okay, here are the five that I think are worth your time.
Yes.
I mean, that actually kind of turns it around, because sure does. Then you're talking about helping to find the gold from the dross.
And there, you know, it, surely the ultimate of publishing is writers and readers, getting the right book, the right reader at the moment that reader is interested or, excited by that topic or interested in that information. And the system, you know, the system has always been very inefficient. It's, you know, it was hugely inefficient when it was all just bricks and mortar retail. Then it was grotesquely inefficient. If you wanted a book, you special ordered it, you waited 3 weeks. So then we get Amazon online retail, far more efficient, but still, as you're pointing out, you know, it's inefficient in that matching of really matching writers and readers. Amazon has its algorithm, but we've all seen that they're pretty kludgy. Every now and again, it comes up with a good suggestion, but it comes up with so many terrible ones along the way.
Well, you could imagine, you know, then a kind of reader-writer interaction machine where I would put in all of my information about wants, almost like, you remember in the old days with used books, rare books, you would send out a want list if you were a buyer. Yeah. And then the rare book dealers would comb through the want lists and match it up with what that rare book is that they had. And of course, now we have ABE, which more or less fills that role. But you could do, if you, let's say, had a reader analysis you know, a reader kind of survey, and I put in all of my information about the things I'm interested in. Here are the 500 books that I can remember reading and the 10 that I thought were my favorites. And this is what I want. I'm interested in poetry and I want long form. I really like Patterson, the long poem, whatever it is. And then the machine has, the publishers would then pay on the other side to have their books ingested and categorized and summarized and qualitatively measured. And then the recommendation machine would spit out to me, here are the five books you should be buying. Yeah. And it, so, you know, and I would buy those books.
Criticism of that would always be the criticism that we see of the Amazon algorithm is that, you know, it only gives you what you think you want.
But you can build, but you can build surprise into a, you know, an intelligent system can build surprise also.
I think so. I think so too.
Because a bookseller would not know you that well. You know, it's it was sort of a myth that a bookseller could size you up and say, here's a book I know you're going to like. Some were
that
really,
was a myth.
Yeah, it didn't always work. And so the machine might not always be right, but surprise is also pretty good. Like it might give me a book completely randomly. Like here's a book on fly fishing, and I've never been fishing in my life, but maybe it turns out that that's the book that makes me want to go fishing. I kind of, you know, it is sort of nice to think about the positive side.
Yes.
Since, you know, in the publishing industry for a long time, people are usually looking at technology and bemoaning its effect or, you know, complaining about how hard things are, which are all legitimate because publishing is very difficult and it is laborious. And people love books, but they also know how hard it is to do all this stuff.
But then if AI were to make most of that 90% simpler, then what are we doing as publishers? And it, you know, are we just gatekeepers? What is our role? And was our role defined by difficulty in that sense? You know, that you look at the history of publishing and it's always been, you know, the barriers of production that qualified the individual to form the organization that could tackle that. That's what the publisher is. But the mythology is that they're tastemakers, which, you know, indeed they're also that. But if you couldn't do the logistics, you couldn't be a publisher. Now with AI, it can do the logistics. So what is a publisher?
Right. And that's, I think that is a really interesting challenge. Because we, you know, as people who are interested in publishing do feel that their core job is to discover great writing and make it available to people. That's why you're doing this. If you're a publisher, it's because you really believe that there are great books and you really want them to be in the hands of readers. That's the simplest element of it. So if the technology could make it easier for you to do that, we should welcome it.
Yes. You know, and they also recognize the fact that most books are not that great. Sort of, they come into the industry wanting to, you know, publish the next Margaret Atwood, and they end up publishing a book on fly fishing. Absolutely not. But I agree about that. But we also see, you know, there's probably 700 books on fly fishing, of which three are really good and the rest kill the
That's self. True. Well, you know, it does. The 80-20 rule doesn't work without the 80.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. Yeah, good point.
So aside from AI, what kind of technology and future thinking are you enthralled by right now? Or is AI mainly the focus?
AI is everything for me right now. You know, it's so all encompassing. When I first saw ChatGPT and started analyzing what it could do and couldn't do, there were lots of things it couldn't do. Now there's literally nothing that I know of in publishing that it can't tackle. I did a webinar a couple months ago with the American Society of Indexers, and to prepare for that webinar, I had ChatGPT indexed my book. And my God, it was good. It was like, let's do a first index, first pass through. Let's go to the next level of complexity. Let's now use the Chicago Manual of Style for the index. And it was just like bang, bang, bang. And they were really, really good. So, there's nothing I'm seeing yet that it can't do. And so for the first time in my career, I do believe that the technology will be vastly transformative rather than with desktop publishing, which we, at one point imagined or were excited to think that it would be vastly transformative, but all it ended up doing was transforming the methods of production and didn't change much else about the business.
So do you, if you, let's say a publisher, I'm sure publishers hire you to do this stuff, but just in terms of general advice, if a publisher said, I'm a smaller publisher, I don't have time for a lot of stuff, what should where do I start? What should I do? How do I even just get started? What would you recommend to people?
There's the, besides my own book on AI and book publishing, which I think I did an okay job of, sort of a once over for people. So, it's a short book, it's 25,000 words. And, I cover the waterfront. Don't go too deep. As written to be a really friendly book, and so on and so on. So I've had pretty good feedback on that. The other book that I recommend in my book, and whenever I'm talking to people, there's a guy named Ethan Mollick, M-O-L-L-I-C-K. And he has a great blog called One Useful Thing, and he's got his book out, Co-Intelligence. And I do recommend to every publisher, read his blog and or his book. And so then you'll start to get a feeling for the landscape. And then it's like, use ChatGPT and don't use it for half an hour. Mollick always says you need 10 hours. Commit yourself to doing 10 hours, not 10 hours in a, but over a period of weeks, devoting that much time to it. And then decide, if after 10 hours you're like, I just don't see it. Fine. You're allowed to reject AI. It's not obligatory. And there's lots of concerns that are absolutely valid. I do say to publishers, life will continue whether you take on AI or not. But I also think that publishing is such a challenged industry economically. If you can, my challenge to publishers is let's drive out 15% of your cost and let's sell 15% more books with this technology. Those are the dual goals that I set for them or argue that they should set. And if you can do that, this would be a far stronger industry.
So, and what the two things that I've noticed are attracting a fairly large amount of technology investment are translation from English or any language into any other language, which obviously would be interesting to publishers. And then the other thing is audio, which,
yes,
not just because of audiobooks, but because audio conversion of text to audio is so ubiquitous in business use. You can, the applications are immense, but it spills over. Audiobooks could theoretically be fairly readily transformed by AI, where the voices are getting better and better. I don't know whether we're there yet.
We are there. We are actually there yet. And, people, again, it's one of those things where they've heard a couple of examples. And they go, those are really crummy. And it's like, it's not there yet. And it's like, do your homework, check out companies like 11 Labs and what they're able to do. And suddenly you'll go, oh, it's there. So if it's there and translation as well, people are like, oh, it couldn't possibly translate as well as, these literary translators. And it's like, well, that doesn't necessarily matter much. We're not talking about translating the finest literature being translated into the European languages or other languages. That can still happen. We can still hire translators for that, which we must, finally craft every single word. But when you look at my book, for example, I use ChatGPT to translate it into 31 languages. And with people, when they read it, they go, it's not perfect, but it was fine. I could understand it. And I was able to do that in 3 hours.
Did you publish it in 31 languages?
Yes. Yeah. And I've got, AI generated French audiobook, AI generated German audiobook, And you know, it's been, by living through this, it's really been an eye opener.
And did you have it translate the metadata also?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was part of the system.
So how do you validate in languages that you don't know?
I get people who know the languages to validate. And I spot checked it. It's, you know, if my book was a more important book, I would have put more effort into it. But it was like, I just want to see, you know, I'm just going to throw it out there and see what happens. And it was like, wow, I'm getting very positive feedback. I used the LeanPub platform. Did we talk about that? You know, they're amazing for self-published authors who are doing books that are in technology topics in particular, and that they change rapidly. My book, I've already revised it 4 times, and you get the latest version whenever you download it. So I just publish the updates on, you know, like one button, new version, and that's available to people instantly. So it's a remarkable platform, and they have a way of doing these 31 translations for $499, I think it was, for the whole thing.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So yeah. Is there a particular publisher, or are there some publishers that you think are really integrating AI well that you know of that you would call exemplars?
Not at all. There's so much resistance. There still is a huge amount of resistance. Much of it comes because the authors are still, you know, up in arms. The authors are very much up in arms because clearly the AI companies did purloin a lot of copyrighted text. There's no question about it. You know, the legal issue is whether or not technically that was so-called fair use. But in, you know, the reality is they did ingest thousands and thousands of copyrighted books. And that's, you know, if not illegal, ethics are, you know, pretty grim around that one. And for authors to say, yeah, they stole my book and now they want me to use this technology and give them $20 a month, I understand the outrage. But then they go to it, oh, and the publishers who I work with, they're using this technology that's based on my stolen book. Yes, of course, there's lots of reasons for the outrage, but at some point, you got to get over it. We got to move forward, because it's, you know, it's going to move forward with you or without you.
Well, and eventually, I think there may be enough legal action to cause there to be some payment made that will at least make up for some of the stolen benefits.
That's what we hope for. That would be fair. That would, you know, clearly fair on the ordinary terms that you and I or any author working would be, yes, if I'm compensated, that would be fair.
Well, and there's another way of looking at it is if I was an author whose work had been, as purloined is a great word, by the way, who would, mm-hmm. if I was someone whose work had been purloined, I would be the first person to want to use that technology to make more money. Because yep. then essentially I would be taking advantage of all of the technological benefit and using it for my own gain. And yep. it would at least help pay me back for the loss. So maybe that's a better way of looking at it is don't reject it. Use it. Take advantage of it. You know, they may have stolen it, but it's a tool that you can use now.
That's true. That's a very good positive attitude. Yeah, I'll share that with them.
Well, on that's a good positive note. It's probably a good place to end. I really want to thank you, Thad, for taking the time. It was really fun talking.
Thank you, David. Thanks for inviting me.
Covered a lot of different subjects and with no particular theme, which I think is my pleasure. You know, it's part of the pleasure of doing this. We get to just talk and see where it goes.
I like that too.
Thanks again. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Thad McElroy of The Future of Publishing.